Te reo ererangi o te mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
Assalamu alaikum, kia ora, and welcome to In Transit, the series where we center the many journeys of immigrant ethnic women navigating life in Aotearoa, New Zealand, with me, your host, Hafsa. In each episode, I sit down with women who share their journeys of settling in a new land, the challenges they have faced, and the resilience that carried them through. From cultural clashes to quiet triumphs, and from moments of doubt to deep appreciation, these are raw, honest, and hopeful conversations. Whether you're new to the country or simply curious, this is your space to listen, learn, and connect. Kia ora, and welcome back to another episode with another migrant woman who has moved to New Zealand over the past few years. So welcome on the show, Morenike.
Yeah, hi, Afsa. Nice to chat with you once again. I think we've done this a few times.
Yes, you had invited me on your podcast.
Yeah.
I guess, Morenike, my first question is, who are you and what do you do?
Wow, that's an ambiguous question. I've found the redefinition of that concept of who you are. I think moving to a new land has kind of made me to be wary of how to answer that question. The reality is before 10 years ago, so it's going to be 10 years that I moved to New Zealand towards the end of this year. I think I arrived 31st of March, of May 2015. So that's coming on to 10 years now. And if you ask me who I was before I migrated, I'd simply tell you I'm a lecturer. That would be like topmost. I'm a lecturer, I lecture, and then maybe go on to tell you I'm a mom, I'm a wife. But moving to New Zealand, you know, because the movement was also, or migrating was tied to purpose. And so it was tagged along, you know, wanting to find one's purpose. So why did I move to New Zealand? And if I ask you, what do you do? Who are you? Oh, on arrival 10 years ago, I was a PhD student. The sole purpose was to study for a PhD in media and communication. And I completed that in 2019 from the University of Canterbury. Now, completing that PhD kind of also began to reorganize my life in a way. Now, what do you do? What is the next step? How do you continue to find purpose? Like I said, my career path has been teaching, lecturing in the university. And one way or the other, that didn't work out here in New Zealand when I completed my PhD. And I decided to stay on and not go back for, you know, personal and family concern. So, yeah, I began to, okay, what is the next step? And I began to notice the disparity in a skill-based society or culture. So this is not about, oh, you have a PhD and then you end a job. No, this is about what skill do you have? We're not even concerned about if you have a PhD or not. What skill do you have? So this was a whole new learning for me, wanting to discover where to align my purpose and my skills. While I was doing my PhD, I was working in disabilities, and that continued for a while. And while in disability, I went on to do some administrative role. But then, you know, suddenly last year, I just sat down and I'm like, I'm still not where I want to be. I've still not found the purpose. And it seems teaching keeps calling me. And so currently, I'm about rounding up my training. So what I discover is to be an high school teacher in New Zealand, you still need to set your papers in order, and it's mostly advisable you do the training. So I'm currently doing that training. It's a year long. I'm in the last lap of the training. So I guess before the end of this year, if you ask me, what do you do? I guess the topmost of the list would be, oh, I'm an English teacher in an high school in New Zealand. And then, you know, also tied to purpose, when you say, what do you do? I'll tell you, I'm a mom. So I have three girls that I look after, three young women, I call them, that I look after. I'm a wife. I'm also a pastor. Wearing so many hats. I'm also a pastor. We pastor a church with my husband. And finally, to the sweetest of them all, I love to cook. And this has become a passion and a business. So one of my side also is preparing orders. People pre-orders quite a number of Nigerian food from me. I run what we call Nigerian Mama's Kitchen. And I also sell African food stuff, you know, mostly West African food items. So, yeah, that is me.
Nice. And that is, so that is such a multi-talented introduction, I would say. And I'm sure, that it was all hard work to get to where you got to. I don't think you mentioned where you are coming from into New Zealand.
Oh, okay. So migration was from Nigeria, West Africa, Africa. And I always put it out there so that people will know that Africa is not a country. It is a continent of 56 countries. And Nigeria is one of the countries in the western part of Africa, which has about 17 countries. So I'll just lay it out there. I'm from the southern western part of Nigeria, from a tribe called the Yoruba tribe. So, yeah, we speak a language called Yoruba. So, yeah, that is me in addition. And I think I also left out, you see, when you're trying to fix who you are into a box, you kind of sometimes can't fix all into it. Mm. And one of the passion and skill that I also do on the side for public interest, for human interest and migrant community, migrant women, just as AFSAT is doing, is running a podcast called The Bold Women on the Move.
Yeah. Yes, yes. And then there's some very inspiring stories there. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. So tell me about the first day when you arrived in New Zealand. You know, what do you remember most about that first day here? What was the weather like? What did it feel like?
Okay, so very much like the weather we have now, you know. So I always say, when people ask me, how long have you been in New Zealand? I'll tell them 10 winters ago, because winters was, it was what I, you know, remember came into New Zealand. It was the eve of June 1st. I arrived 31st of May. So it was already cold. For me, it was already winter. So it was winter. What do I remember? Subsequent days, I continue to remember the day getting short and cold and dark easily. I remember walking from where I was staying then to the campus, the University of Canterbury campus. And when I leave in the morning, it will be bright. And when I'm coming back, it will be already dark. Like, I never really get to see daylight for so many months. I also remember that my favorite piece of clothing was my perfect jacket. And I think I can vividly remember that the first time in a day that I didn't have to put on my perfect jacket was finally in January of the following year. So for 6 months, my puffer jacket was my most precious piece of clothing because of how I found the weather really, really cold. Yeah, that's about it. That's how I remember winter from my first day of arriving here. Yeah.
So winter, cold winter. I know. I think I might have heard you somewhere speak about that first winter when you when you all jacketed up.
Yeah. I couldn't obey those rules that, oh, when you get indoors, you take off the jacket. Like most places weren't warm enough. Like most people will not heat up their home. I felt it wasn't warm enough. So pardon me, I have to keep my jacket on. Yeah, even when I'm indoors, I just couldn't take it off.
Yeah, it was my experience as well. So I know you mentioned that you were a lecturer in Nigeria before you came to New Zealand. So what were you lecturing in, and what was the role that you were playing in there in Nigeria?
Okay, so back in Nigeria, when I finished school, uni, I studied English for my first degree, and then went on to do a master's in, because it was English education, I'd always wanted to be a teacher. So I did a second degree in what is called language education. But before then, I had done a diploma in mass communication. So mass communication is the equivalent of media studies or communication studies in most parts of the world, or journalism. So I'd done a diploma in that. So armed with a degree in English education, a diploma in media studies, the first key job I got 2 years after I graduated was in a university. It was my state university, and they were just about to start we call it mass communication, which encompasses all the areas of communication, you know, and journalism and media studies. Yeah, so they were just starting the department. So I was one of the pioneer staff of the Department of Mass Communication in Olabisi Onabanjo University. Was in Ogun State, yeah, southwestern part of Nigeria. Yeah, I was on the job. Yeah, I started, like I said, I was one of the pioneers. I started as a graduate assistant and move on to become an assistant lecturer. You know, I was at that space for quite a while because I hadn't gotten my PhD, which was one of the reasons why I was really determined to get a PhD. You know, so that I could rise through the rank and, become professor. That was the goal then. Yeah, so spent 11 years lecturing in Olabisi Onabanjo University before coming into New Zealand for my PhD in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And your PhD here was also in media and communication?
My PhD was in media and communication. Yeah,
right.
Which aligned with, the goal was to go on to be a lecturer in the university, publish papers, and become a professor. That was the dream.
Yeah, and then you've had to shift a few of those goalposts.
Well, yeah, so quickly, there were a number of factors, okay? Mm-hmm. There were a number of factors. One of the reasons why my PhD got, I would say, delayed, because I had my second master's in 2006. So I pretty much could have even finished my PhD back in Nigeria before 2015. So I didn't, you know, start as soon as I should have. There was a bit of a delay. But the goal was still, when I eventually get my PhD, you know, continue lecturing. But then when we arrived there, I came in the first year by myself. The second year, my family joined me.
Mm.
And my oldest girl, when they arrived there, was 13. So by the time I completed my PhD in 2019, that was the year she also was completing her high school here in New Zealand.
Mm.
So we now began to discuss, you know, I think 2 years, 1 year into my PhD, the plan was still to go back to Nigeria. But by the time I completed and she completed, the reality was there was obvious disparity in education. So she had left the educational, the high school system in Nigeria. And for her to go back, and by that time, in fact, amazed because most kids our age would have finished high school at 16.
Yeah.
But in New Zealand, you finish high school at 18. So even 2 years before she finished high school here, most of our mates were already in the university.
Wow.
So by the time she finished high school here, if she had to go back to Nigeria, there were some exams to do to get into Nigerian university. So, you know, and having studied outside, I was just looking at the challenges of navigating that. And we were like, okay, I think the wisest thing as a family is just to stay on and allow the girls to go through their education. Because it was also a bit of a struggle for them to settle in here. Up till today, my first daughter will still always talk about her trauma, the challenges she faced in adjusting to the school. There were, she was like, I think there was another Zimbabwean girl in the school. This was a large school of over 1,000 kids, and there were just two or three black girls in the school. And she really found it difficult to adjust. But, you know, by the time she finished high school, she was adjusting. And we realized moving have a great impact on them. So moving back again to Nigeria, that means they will have to adjust again because most of their friends have also moved on. So you get, so it was like always alienating them. So that was why we felt, okay, stay on here, finish your school, and then we can, you know, move on. So that stopped me from going back to Nigeria. And then I began to also look at the opportunities here. To be candid, New Zealand is a small country, relatively small country. Mm-hmm. You know, a country of 5 million. Mm-hmm. I came from a country of 250 million. So you can imagine the gap. And in terms of academic university, just 6 universities. So there weren't many vacancies in that field. You know, as I did quite a number of applications. I don't think there's any university in New Zealand that offers media studies or communication that I hadn't applied to at a time. So, so the reality was just to begin to find a substitute career that will begin to, you know, use the same skills one has learned. And one of it was, you know, the podcast I started and finding my way back to teaching, where I feel I can maximize my skills, my knowledge, and my learning. Yeah, so, yeah, that is it.
Yeah. So I know you said you've got your PhD now, which is great, and you're training to, like, you're going through that training of becoming that secondary school, high school teacher, and what I want to know, Marenike, is you did mention that there was a plan that when you came here and you had something about getting into the university and getting into the role of a lecturer. What were some of the barriers when you applied after you finished your PhD? It's a big sigh.
Yeah, because it's really difficult to know, you know. I think a few of the application I did, I think one, which was in my department, the department I finished from, I knew was in charge of the application. So I called afterwards to find out, is there a reason, you know? I just feel that in most of those cases, like I've done the analysis of those that have been employed, they kind of feel there is preference for other maybe scholars that are still actively in, maybe that have taught in the Western part of the world, and some are still actively teaching in the university. and are just willing to move to New Zealand. So they are still academics, you know, currently academic where they are, but they just want to move to New Zealand. So that seems to be most of the jobs that, I mean, the way the job has panned out. So it's just, there are quite a number of applicants, and there will just be one thing or the other that, in a way, it edges you out. Yeah, I guess that is it. And the reality for me is when I arrived, I was a self-sponsored student. So one of the challenges I had for my PhD and why it delayed that long, I couldn't get sponsorship or scholarship. So I was self-sponsored. In case you are listening, New Zealand is one of the countries in the world that has the cheapest cost for PhD, because they allow you to pay, what's it called?
Domestic fees.
Domestic rates. Okay, so when I arrived, you know, I was able to do that. So, but then I had to work, okay? Mm. And I noticed that to be an academic, you know, they weren't really paying much. You know, I remember signing up for some tutoring at that time. It wasn't much. It wasn't meeting my bill. Mm. So I couldn't put myself forward, you know, take on more tutoring and be, you know, like be around the campus in a kind of a way, you know, be around academics in a kind of a way. Those were like real great sacrifices. Not that you are being employed, but, you know, just maybe hang around, do a paper with someone and all that. I couldn't pay that price of living the life of an academic because it wasn't paying my bill at that time, and there was no official role. So I guess I just made up my mind to look out. I did try some, you know, ministry jobs, you know, try to see if I can get some ministry placement job. That didn't pan out also well as much as I would love it to. So yeah, it didn't just work out. They were preferring other, most, like I said, people that I think most universities in New Zealand, if they are not employing Kiwis as academics, then it will be mostly maybe US-based academics that are willing to move here, or UK-based scholars that are willing to move here. They look up to those places, and they are usually their first port of call if they are, you know, looking for lecturers in universities. So, but another thing is that, you know, most lecturers, there weren't that many vacancies. Like I know in my department, there was just one. They are dead. a funny thing, one of my professors told me that unless some of us die, you know, it was just funny. It was just the reality, you know, the academic, they are long, it's a long life job, you know. So there wasn't just that vacancy. Yeah, I guess that was just it.
Right. So yeah, the change of plan and moving into a new career, I guess, with the with the secondary schools. And what does that feel like?
I guess, like I said, moving to a new country helps you to readjust and realign your purpose, what you call purpose. And no one, in my own experience, I don't know if any other person, you know, experienced this, no one a role, okay? How my life has turned out is that one single role does not describe me. That's why I said I'm always kind of, I don't want to use the word scared, but I'm always kind of wary of when you ask me, what do you do? And, you know, giving you a title of what I do, because I do so many things that fulfill me. Okay. And I could keep to one of these things if I have enough money, and I'll just do it and I'll be happy. Okay. I'm a mom. That's a full-time job on its own, you know? It's a full-time job on its own. And if not for bills, I'm meeting needs, you know, You could do it and you enjoy it and, you know, play home and everyone comes home, the food is there for them. You look after them, you drop them off, you pick them up. That's so much job.
I could
do the Bold Women on the Move podcast and, you know, turn it around and maybe make it into something more like a training school, or that there are things to do in it, you know, if it's able to pay my bills. Because one thing that has become more obvious since I moved to this country is meeting those economic need, having economic power, because you are moving, you know, you don't have a foundation wealth. You know, I don't have my dad is not here. The land he bequeathed to me is not here. You know, my generational wealth is not here. I'm just starting to build. So most times, most of us migrants, we're starting to build.
Yeah.
Okay. Especially if we're first generation migrants, we're just starting to build. So I'm just starting to build. So if not for that need, you know, I could say, oh, okay, I could just do this business. You know, if you have ordered food from me, if you have met me in the kitchen, if you have been to my home, the question people ask me is, why don't you just start a restaurant? You know, why don't you start a restaurant? And I'll ask myself the question, will it fulfill me, you know, to just be cooking and cooking every day for people to buy? I'm not sure if that, but I enjoy it. So I said this to say that it's like, you know, there are just so many things that when you move, for me, how it has panned out, and I think it's an advantage because, you see, I reason things and I'm like, if I'm still back in Nigeria, I probably would just still only be a lecturer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
You know, I wouldn't venture into podcasting. I probably would just be teaching my students about it, but not venture into it, you know. But be an academic, I teach classes, publish papers, you know. Isn't that a boring life? Apologies to those that are academics. You know, I don't mean it that way, but I just feel it's one thing. But moving to another country, I think the survivor instinct in me has brought out all these skills, all these things that I'm doing, and I'm finding purpose. And each of it is huge on its own. Like, you know, in the last 1 year, this training that I'm doing is huge. Like, it has shaken me. Is molding me. Sometimes I ask myself, are you sure you're an intelligent person? You know, I'm challenged. My intelligence is challenged, you know, by the classes, the lectures, the papers you have to do, learning a new module to teach, you know, moving from, because being a lecturer, you are more or less, you have a more or less a teacher-centered pedagogy. Now you're moving to a learner-centered pedagogy. You know, your focus is, what do my students need? And each of them are different and you want to meet them. So it's totally different and challenging. But I think I'm loving my life. I'm loving the way it's turning out to be. Okay. I just need wisdom to be able to realign and put everything in perspective and, you know, do the little I can do here and here, maybe make more dollars. More dollars should come so that I can do more fun things. Yeah. Okay.
No, I agree. I think one of the things that does become a challenge for some migrants is the financial sustainability of surviving here, and that's why we do end up doing multiple things, or, you know, pursuing multiple passions which we never thought of in when we were in our home countries. So I know you mentioned about, you know, if I was living back there, I wouldn't have done all this or tried and tested. I guess my next question is around the fact that, if, you know, what is the biggest difference you noticed between while you were in Nigeria and what here in New Zealand, both positive and negative, if we were to kind of look at it that way, around what are the significant differences?
Well, significant differences They are varied. For example, if I say in terms of career, like I said, was more or less I had a career, a defining one by the name. Not necessarily would have been the most, it is fulfilling, you know. I enjoyed it. I loved it. I've always loved any form of teaching. So, but it was like, I had a career and it was, but looking back at that career, like I say now, it looks smaller than what I could do, you know. Mm-hmm. I feel I have more opportunity to be more in terms of my career, you know. And that's what I feel, you know. It doesn't necessarily mean for some other people, our story, our paths, our journeys are different. For some other people, maybe they found a larger career here, you know, and it could be a single career, you know, maybe government or something, and it's huge for them. So I think our journey are just different. So that for me is a form of change. Life is more busy here. Life is more busy because it's like you're starting life all over again.
Mm-hmm.
You're learning new culture, new language. I'm learning Tirio.
Mm-hmm.
So you're learning a new language. You want to understand a new culture. Okay. And even though we speak English, my darling, the innuendos here, the slangs. I'm listening to my colleagues making joke. I can't laugh. I don't understand the joke. Okay, I want to laugh, but I don't understand the joke, you know. So those little things, you know, it's like you're having to learn at every step of the journey. At 10 years, and I'm still learning. Okay, so it's like life, the difference from Nigeria to here is like starting all over again. I think migrating made me realize how hard it is. And the concept of change in our podcast, you remember I invited you, I've penned down some questions, and this question is the main thing I wanted you to come and answer for us. You know, I haven't related with quite a number of migrant women. That concept of change, you know, what it is, what changed, everything changed. You can't be the same when you move. Okay, your career is going to change. Even if you were in a set career, like if you were a medical doctor, when you move to a new country, you have to re-certify yourself to be able to practice. And a lot of people find it challenges. I knew of quite a number of medical doctors that when they arrived there, it took them almost 10 years or almost, you know, quite a number of years before they could practice here. Because of a lot of, you know, steps they had to go through to be able to get there. So that change is there. Do we want to talk about food?
Yeah, absolutely.
The idea behind my business started because of the first day I walked into Pack and Save and the season of yams. And they were like, yam on sale. And I was so excited. And I was walking to the vegetable, you know, section to see the yam. And I saw some tiny little things called yams. And I'm like, yams? This is shocking. Do you know what we call yam back in Nigeria? To see the huge tubers of yam. We call it tubers of yam. Like, it should be weighing, one tuber of yam could weigh as much as 2 kg or more.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So you can imagine how shocked I was. One of our staple food, cassava, nowhere to be found.
Oh,
you know, yeah, you know, so you begin to realize that things that you took for granted, you know, every day you go to the mall and, you know, back there you go to big super malls and you get them. Now you come to big super malls here and you can't find them. So that begin to be a challenge to you. How about the way we raise our kid? Those are immense differences. Now I have to learn to realign. See, most times when I talk about all these changes, what has worked for me is that you find out that I've become so positive about them that I only look at the good side of them. But once in a while, you could miss some of those things, you know, that way that you resolve things. For example, your child offends you in the house and you resolve it. You give them a piece of the punishment, the right one, a good whack.
Yeah.
You know, a good whack. And they sit up and come around and apologize, you know. But here you have to do conversation. You have to learn it. So this is another skill of parenting. Okay. Different from the skill you have learned from your culture. Now you have to learn another skill of parenting. You have to learn new ways of discipline. You still want to discipline them, but now you're learning a new way of disciplining them. So totally different. How about the way we practice our religion? Okay, totally different. Everybody have a faith. Everyone have a belief. Everyone have a religion different from yours. And you're now learning to respect them. Okay, you're learning to relate with them. You know, you're learning to want to understand their religion too. Okay, and just live with people around you. So there is just so much in the way we live our life. Another concept that I haven't really gotten around accepting is this concept of, I've forgotten the word, but you know, when time changes from 11 to 12.
Daylight saving.
Oh yeah. My goodness. It still messes my head up.
You're not alone. After even 18 years, it still messes me up.
Yeah, and I'm like, why are they adjusting the clock? Why can't they just leave the time as it is? And I don't understand why daylight savings. I really don't see. So yeah, those are enormous changes. And as a woman also, you begin to see yourself culturally, your cultural role change. You are more aware of yourself. You are more aware of your power, of your choices, okay? Even when you are in a relationship, you are more enlightened. You're more enlightened about the way you do things. Yeah, I believe, you know, there's more support for you. So to be able to challenge some of your cultural biases, you know, to challenge them, this is the time, this is an opportunity for you to challenge those things. And there is support, you know, in the society. So yeah, those are the changes. They are all over every area of our life. They encompass, and they are continuous things. I'm not sure that as migrant women, because I know you said we are calling New Zealand home. I don't know. Do you think there will come to a state where we will fully feel at home?
I don't know. I think that's a question I want to explore. Is I think before that, before we even go to that question, is the question of, I think there are three different questions that will come before that question, is in terms of your cultural identity and how much does that matter? And I guess plus it is also about whether your cultural identity is important to you. So what would you say to that question?
About cultural identity? I think for me, there will be a number of things that will form my culture. My culture as a Yoruba woman, for example, that's my tribe, that's my ethnic group. I don't think it's been contested in any way. Okay. Luckily for us in our ethnic group, we are a widely traveled set of people. If you check our statistics, I'm not sure, but we are like the ethnic group that is most sparsely traveled and educated in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And we've still been able to keep the good things in our culture. So what I do, you know, in order not to lose my cultural identity, I think in a lot of way, I will always put the goods in my culture beside what I see in other culture and go for the better.
Right.
Okay, go for the better. That's how. So in that, there is also a realignment, a kind of, what do you call it now? a cauldron. It's like you're mixing thing. So another culture is coming up. Okay, another culture is coming up. It's a fusion of two different cultures, or even more than two different cultures, because you know this is New Zealand, where you're able to meet with variants of cultures. So yeah, for example, I think it's in the English culture to, you know, when you meet a stranger, you are not too outgoing. You politely say your hello, and then you keep to yourself as much as possible. But it's in my culture to, when you meet a stranger, to want to make them feel at home immediately. Mm-hmm. You want to, you know them. You want to. So I'll pick my culture in that regard. I'll pick to want to, you know, to want to be welcoming and be open, to be expressive. My culture is very expressive. I think I'll continue to keep being expressive, you know, as a person. Mm-hmm. It also tallies with my personality. So I guess it works well for me. I'll keep that part of it. So there are some things in my culture that I'll keep my food. You can't contest that.
Oh,
good. Well, I'll keep my food because I feel it tastes better. You know, that's not to say that I will not. I've tried quite a number of Kiwi cuisine, but I'll make it. But finally, I'll add my pepper to it, real pepper. I'll make shepherd pie. I'll make shepherd pie and I'll add my pepper to it. I'll make the sauce spicy before, you know, adding the, you know, so I'll do all that. So you can see the fusion, you know, that I was talking about. I don't think I would say that I'm losing my culture. I would just say that if I use the word polishing, it would be like I'm demeaning my culture. So I will use the word I'm realigning it to suit my new environment, my new society, the need of my society, because I don't want to lose myself.
Yeah.
If I lose my culture, I lose myself. I don't want to lose myself. Of course, for example, my dressing has changed. Some of the styles and material in my culture does not fit into this weather. Mm. Okay. So that has changed. I don't think I ever wore pants while I was in Nigeria.
Very true. Very true. Neither did I.
I don't think I ever wore pants. I don't think I did. Now, it seems to be the only thing I wear, you know. Yeah. So those are things, for example, you know, in your culture that begin to change. And like I said, the way I raise my children also, I'm redefining it. Assert myself in my relationship is different because I'm more aware, you know. I'm more aware of what it means to be me, and I want to live a fulfilling life. And I'm grateful that I have a husband. I don't want to use the word partner. That's another thing with culture. To me, it's husband, you know. I'm grateful that it's someone that aligns with my purpose and, you know, is always willing to be supportive and work in line.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you say my cultural identity, have I lost it? Is there any change? I don't think I've lost it, because look at it. I've lived more of my life as a Nigerian than I've lived so far as a Kiwi. And I think those first 40 years of my life have shaped me in more ways that I can never know. I think I'm become more accepting of who I am. I think with culture, when you look at culture, there is ethnic culture, there is religious culture, then there is what we can call societal expectation, like humanity as a culture. So I've adopted humanity as a culture, you know. There are things that in every culture shouldn't be acceptable. For example, putting others down, it shouldn't be acceptable, you know. So I wouldn't practice that and say, oh, okay, I'm in a different culture, so my culture is to put people down. Luckily, we didn't have that back in Nigeria. Like I said, my tribe was, I'll call it an educated tribe. So they had imbibed, generations before me, like two generations before me, had imbibed Western culture. So most of these were not strange. So we didn't have all this societal stratification, you know. So, you know, these high level class structures in the society, we didn't really have that. So here it's easy to fit into when you come into a secular society like New Zealand, where everyone is called by their name. So outside New Zealand, back in Nigeria, that's a big deal. In my tribe, it's a sign of respect. You don't call people by their first name if they are older than you. That's disrespectful. Mm-hmm. But you see here, of course, I know that there's still also some level of respect. You know, calling people by their name does not mean you disrespect them. Back in, for example, look at my culture. You could not call me by my name and still disrespect me through other ways.
Yeah.
And here, you could be calling me by my names and be showing me respect in other ways.
Yeah.
So, you know, so where we have put up some signposts as a representation of this is an evidence that you respect me because you don't call me by my name. I'm realigning that kind of expectation now. So yeah, I guess that's what culture has become for me. A lot of, and it comes back down to that concept of, you know, change. Same, you can't remain static.
So, yeah, no, yeah. And I like the use of the word that you've got about realign. That is really a good way to put it, because none of us as migrants or immigrants, whatever you want to call that, are living our culture to the fullest, because all of us have had to make that adaptable and, like you said, realign it with what New Zealand is. And some of it is good for us, and some of it we don't know. We feel a little bit uncomfortable doing it, which I think is also part of what, because then that leads to the next question, which is the second question before we get to the question of home, is does that mean that when we have realigned and have made some adjustments, how acceptance happens for us in the community, or how easy was it for you, or is it for you, Morenike, to build those, I guess, build social connections plus also find acceptance?
I guess that will be from the fact that, as I earlier mentioned, every society have the human rule by which everyone operates by. And I think that sits at the top before you now bring your unique self, which is your culture. Okay. So when you talk about social connection, or, you know, when you get into a place, there are rules of engagement in that place. Before you now bring who you are, you first align with those rules of engagement, okay? Once you align with those rules of engagement, it gives you an hero to be accepted into that setting. And then you can now begin to express who you are. You can begin to express your culture. And I think that's the way I've done it. I get into a place of work. For example, a place of work, rules of engagement, get to work on time, no lateness, be respectful, be polite. If you have disputes against someone, there are ways to go about the dispute. There are ways to, you know, to have conversation. If people are, you know, if there's like a get together, an afternoon where everyone is having tea together, you show up there, you understand, you show up there. And you engage with people. So in between doing all these social connections in the community, things that have been set up, then your culture, your unique self is allowed to play. Like I can turn up to an event, an evening event, in my native attire, for example, to represent my culture. I can turn up with my food. And I've learned to make my food in such a way that it's also accepting, you know, like you go to a place where it's halal meat they eat. So you want to, you know, make sure what you are bringing complies with that requirement, or you go to a place where it's vegetarian or vegan food that they are bringing, and I realized that most of the food in my culture are also actually vegetarian food. So you make it in such a way and you bring it to such a setting. It's still your culture, but you're just making it fit in.
Yeah.
Okay, you're making it fit in. You're putting others first. You're not losing yourself. You're not losing yourself. Okay? You're not losing yourself because I still have my food. I can still talk about, if there's a conversation, I'll be talking about things that I know. So I'm not losing myself. I'll be bringing my perspective. I'll be bringing my culture in, you know. I'll be bringing my worldview into that conversation. So I'm not losing myself as a person. And, you know, that's something that I've also found out in the Maori culture. You know, this is it Fananga Tanga, showing care, you know, to others, you know, to guests. But it doesn't also mean you don't look after yourself, you know, but looking after someone that has come, you know, but you also look after yourself. It doesn't mean you lose yourself. So all those concepts, I think they work for me when it comes to social connection. I don't think I find myself out of place anywhere. And maybe also my personality, that could also be, I thrive in conversation. I thrive where there are, you know, group of people. I haven't found social connection wrong. Now, the other side of it is, do people now accept you as you are?
Yeah.
I can't determine that.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest part, isn't it?
No, it's on them.
Yeah.
I can't determine that.
Mm.
I can't. Okay? I'm not going to go against the laws of the social connection or social group. Mm. And then I'm going to bring my 100% self. But do you accept me as I am? The onus is on you. It's not on me. I don't want to put that burden on me. Now, where I will lose myself and identity is want to make myself acceptable to one or to a setting at all times. Okay? Mm. Meet people's expectation. That's when I'll lose myself. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to, you know, want to meet your expectation. I'm just going to meet the expectation, not your expectation. Okay, so that I don't want to lose myself too.
Yeah. So then that raises the question about, does that mean that New Zealand is home?
10 years. I guess it's becoming home. It's becoming. I can't say it is home yet. I think it's becoming home.
Yeah. But what is home?
Home is where family is. Home is where your loved ones are. Home is where you are accepted. Okay. So if I look at, aside my immediate family, for example, now, all my extended family, but one of my other sisters is outside the country, but all others are still back in Nigeria, you know. So when you also think of home, you think of your loved ones, you know. I think migrating has made me to appreciate them now. You know, when people say, I'm going to my grandfather, I'm going to my mom's place. Oh, I hung out with my mom on the weekend. Those things are treasure now to me. But I'm missing out on them. So I guess because of that, that may not make it to really be fully like home, because you are not able to relate with all your loved ones. You are loved by people here. So that's why I said it's becoming home.
Yeah.
It's not fully home yet, but it's becoming home. Maybe when my kids grow up too, and they get married, and they have their own children, and, you know, we have like 2-3 generations here. For me, home would be, like I said, let me begin to define what home would be for me now. Mm. It would be my loved ones. So, if, for example, I have them here, their generations are here, you know, the next generation to me and then the next generation. Then we have roots in the land. That's one. Number two, purpose. Mm. You know, as my purpose align with the society, I'm yet to find myself in the society. So I can't call this place home yet. Because even after 10 years, my career is still not yet formed here.
Yes, true.
So, and that is important, you know, because when someone meets you for the first time, they will ask you, what do you do? Your career, what you do, it's an important aspect of your personality, of who you are. So if someone is, I'm still, and I'm still, like I've just told you, I'm still grappling with that 10 years after. So in another 5 years, hopefully, you know, possibly we can say, okay, it's home now, and we're now full, you know, because your purpose has to also meet the societal need. Then you find it home. You find purpose in it's meeting the societal need. There is a symbiotic relationship. You are benefiting the society. The society is benefiting you. Okay? You're bringing fulfillment to others. They're bringing fulfillment to you. So that will make it feel like home. Number three, it will become home when some part of my culture is becoming the norm. Okay? Even if it's only people around me. And they began to realize that, oh, she's a Nigerian. Oh, she practiced Christianity. And these are the things that she values. And then I have just a few people around me that respect that, value me for that. You understand? So it begins to become home for me in that regard because I have my own clique. I have my own circle. I have my own people. Not necessarily, you know, my immediate family, but people that believe in me, in what I do, in my culture, in some aspect of my culture that I've brought with me, then it possibly will become home. But 10 years after, I can't say it is home yet. I'll say it's becoming home.
Beautiful. Thank you very much, Marenike. I really appreciate what you shared with us today. And I think it is an ongoing conversation of becoming home for many of us as we continue to navigate life here in New Zealand. So thank you very much for sharing that.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thanks for joining us on In Transit. If today's story moved you, taught you something new, or simply made you feel seen, we'd love for you to share this episode with someone else. Also, don't forget to tune in to Plains Media for the next episode. Until next time, remember, your story matters.